The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you here. A new term starts with City Bible Forum Legal. If you were here last term, you may remember that Peter Jensen, one of our speakers, spoke about a controversial title page that Time magazine published in April 1966. It was kind of a marker, if you like, of how things were beginning to change. And the question was, is God dead? Is God dead? Kind of unthinkable, really, to ask that question a generation before that, but in the 60s it began to be asked. Let me give you a little bit of a broad brush idea of what I think has happened since then. The majority of people would answer that question as, no, God isn't dead. Even in Australia today, the majority of people still list some kind of spiritual or religious beliefs. But as a society, we've started more and more to push God to the edges or actually function as if God is dead. God's dropped out of the picture, or particularly dropped out of the public square. In fact, many people today don't even know someone who attends church. Now, if I could say, I suppose one way of looking at it is, the upside means if God has disappeared, then, hey, we're free. We can do whatever we want. So Dostoevsky's famous quote from the Brothers Karamazov, if God does not exist, then everything is permitted. God's not there. Do whatever you want. There's no right, no wrong, no mean, complete freedom. And I guess many people have embraced that and thought, well, we are free to do whatever we want and move on from what's seen as kind of old and restrictive ideas. If that's the upside, freedom, the downside is we live in an empty and purposeless universe. And so Richard Dawkins, who's the, I guess in many ways, the flag bearer of the new atheists, says this in a very famous quote. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. But hey, we're free. We can do what we want. So 2008, 2009, Richard Dawkins was the patron of a campaign on the site of double-decker buses, mainly in London, a few other cities. It didn't make it to Australia. And the campaign said this. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Fair enough. But maybe they could have chosen a different quote from Richard Dawkins. How about if we put this one, if they put this one on the buses? They're probably, and by the way, I did this. This is my Photoshop work. How good is that? It's the cutting edge of my graphic design ability. But here we go. Imagine if Dr. Dawkins had put this up. There is probably at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. It wouldn't have gone over quite so well, would it? And yet, it's exactly the implication of what he's saying. And so it is interesting that in developed countries, countries that have adopted this kind of empty universe worldview, rates of depression and anxiety are on the rise. And ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you that it's very hard to live without hope. We're actually hardwired to need hope to live. So I don't know if you noticed the last year in Melbourne, the Global Atheist Convention 2018 was called Reason for Hope. And so do you remember the broadcast of what the speakers said and the media coverage of the crowds flocking in, etc.? Do you, anyone remember that? No, because it was cancelled. And why was it cancelled? Well, I'll read you from the website put up. Ticket sales have been substantially below expectations and below levels of previous conventions, so unfortunately the convention cannot proceed. Perhaps people worked out there is no reason for hope, ultimately, if that's all we've got, if we're just hairless apes who unfortunately have achieved self-awareness. Now, I don't think everyone rushed off and became Christians. I just think people, even in Melbourne, found something else to do because what's the hope? We need something that fills the hole in our hearts, something that fills the emptiness. And I can't help but notice I think addiction is becoming more and more of a problem in our society. addiction to, well, it's, whether it's workaholism, alcoholism, porn, video games, social media, shopping, Netflix, you name it. Richard Rohr, who's an American writer, said this. I'm sorry, it's a fairly long quote. I'll just read it to you. Futility and meaninglessness are directly correlated to addiction, in my opinion. When we have meaning, we have need of little else. When we don't have meaning, we can never have enough toys. Somehow we must find that foundational meaning for our lives, or we'll try to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. It can't be done. And you're miserable while you're trying. You must find your North Star outside your own little comparative system, or you'll be lost in rivalry and daily defeat. What's he saying? We need something bigger than ourselves, something outside ourselves to give us purpose and meaning and direction, or we'll, I think we'll just wander around and look for anything to fill it up. And so we come to the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, Ecclesiastes is part of the wisdom books in the Bible. The wisdom books in the Old Testament sit, if you like, beside or slightly outside of the grand narrative of the Bible. The Bible's, you might call, meta-narrative runs from Genesis right through to Revelation, beginning to end. The wisdom books are the writer's attempt to come to terms with what does the world look like, what is the wise way to live in the world that God has created. So Proverbs, about the way the world, I guess the world should work is the way to put it. Job asked a deeper question of why do the innocent suffer. The Song of Solomon is a celebration of romantic love. And then we get to Ecclesiastes. Now Ecclesiastes is about the search for meaning or purpose, but the question is framed in a particular way. And I'll explain that in a moment. So if you look at the quote that you have in front of you on the program, you'll see verses 1 to 3 introduce the author and then give the big question. And then verses 4 to 11 are the evidence that he assembles as he begins to look for evidence to answer the big question. And then 12 to 14 is about a quest that he goes on, a quest that introduces the rest of this brilliant but short little book. So let's have a look. Here we go. The big question. So Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 1. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. A few quick points. The word teacher. The Hebrew word kohelet means someone who speaks in the assembly, the gathering. And the Greek word for gathering is ekklesia. In the New Testament, it's translated as church, the people gathered. But here, they've gone for the Greek word. That's where we get the name of the book, Ecclesiastes. It's the gathering come to listen to the teacher. Notice he calls himself Son of David, King in Jerusalem. It really does point to King Solomon. He never actually says, I am Solomon, but the Son of David, Solomon was king, King David, king in Jerusalem around 1000 BC, Solomon around 950 BC. Solomon was the patron of the wisdom literature, pulled all of these things, particularly the Proverbs, etc., together. So it's written either by Solomon or possibly through the eyes of Solomon towards the end of his life, I think, at the end of being a very rich, very powerful king. All right, that's the introduction to who wrote it. Here's the premise, if you like. He says this, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Here's what I mean about it being needing to just explain the way the question is framed. The word translated meaningless is very hard to come up with an English equivalent of the Hebrew word hebel, or however, that's how it's said with an Australian accent, hebel. Hebel means a mist or a vapour or something that's, yeah, something that you can't hold on to. It's not quite smoke, but it's there and then it's not. And so last week I went for a run in Centennial Park, 6 o'clock, just as the sun's coming up, beautiful, cool morning. And as you run past the playing fields, the mist is across the acres of grass there. Beautiful. But if you come back at 9 o'clock in the morning, it's gone. That's the idea here. It's used figuratively of the idea of something that's transitory, that's unsatisfactory. In the older translation of the Bible, they'd go for vanity in the sense that everything's in vain. So it's a mist, it's a vapour, it's that, okay, very hard to find an English word. Now, they've gone for meaningless, and I see why, and it kind of works. But when you get to chapter 12, he'll say youth and vigour are meaningless. Well, he doesn't mean that. What he means is youth and vigour don't last. They're a mist. Anyway, well, now that you know that, we can kind of proceed. And notice it's twice, meaningless, meaningless. It's the idea of doubling something up to make it sort of the ultimate. Same idea as if you heard the inner part of the Jewish temple was called the Holy of Holies. It's the most holy place. Or the Song of Songs is the most beautiful song. So this is the idea that nothing lasts. Everything seems ephemeral. Everything slips through your fingers. That's what the world feels like. And then verse 3, he gets to the question. This is the question that the whole book seeks to answer. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? So gain is a commercial term. He's saying, what's the bottom line? What's left? Okay, what's the value that we have left after all their labours? And labour can mean either hard physical work or hard mental work. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? You sit at a computer terminal and not move out of your seat for 8 hours and you're exhausted at the end of the day. You know that, yeah. So you can work with a shovel or you can work with a mouse and feel exhausted either way at the end of the day. It's funny, isn't it? And then the little phrase, here's another key to the book, under the sun. 29 times in just 12 short chapters. What does it mean? As far as I can work out, what it means is this. If you just look out at the world, what you see, what happens out there with your eyes open and your common sense, what's the world look like? Now, it's as if God, he says, if God hadn't spoken to us. He's not an atheist. He knows, yeah, God is there and there's sort of, if you like, God's in heaven, yes, and we're down here. But you just look at the world, what does it look like, what happens, how do you make sense of it under the sun? If that's all we had, what does it look like? What do you see? What's our world? Yeah, to the impartial observer, what do you see under the sun? So here's the question. I think I worked out if you take a five-day working week, 13 public holidays, 4 weeks holiday, you have 217 working days in a year. If you have approximately a 45-year working life, some of you younger ones are going to have to work till you're 70 or 80 to look after us baby boomers, but we appreciate it. Thank you. I think that worked out at 9,765 working days. Yeah, 9,765. You'll do that. Work, strain, work, sleep, eat, repeat again and again. What does it all amount to? That's the question he's asking. And so he goes on to have a look at the evidence. Here we are. The evidence, first of all, of nature. See verses 4 to 7. And by the way, it's worth thinking, this was written almost 3,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago. So let's see how up to date he is. How much has the world changed? How much is Solomon still relevant? He says this, verse 4. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. You know, we argue and fight about who owns which piece of real estate or who has rights to which piece of land or who owns which country owns which island or whatever it is, but really, compared to planet Earth, we are bugs hitting the windscreen of eternity. We're only here for a minute or two, boom, and the Earth remains forever. Or verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the north and turns round to, sorry, the wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from. There they return again. Now, he's not talking about the reliability of nature. The Bible teaches that the reliability of nature is a good thing, that creation works on, there are, if we call them, the laws of nature. Why? Because there's a lawgiver who's set up a reliable world. It's a good thing. You make a very strong case that the rise of modern science came out of the Christian worldview because we understood the Christians understood the laws of nature. But that's not what he's talking about here. He's saying it all just feels like a great cosmic groundhog day. It goes around and around and around and around. And if you haven't seen the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray and Andy McDowell, you really should. It's depressing and brilliant all at the same and funny all at the same time. That's what nature feels like. What about human nature? So we're caught in this giant groundhog day. He says, verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. his point. We're only here for 5 minutes, but you get bored with anything, right? Everything gets boring in the end. Example, Kathy and I went on holidays a couple of years ago to Broome, up top left-hand corner of Australia, up in the Kimberleys. Great holiday spot if you want to go, by the way. We hired a four-wheel drive and we drove up to Derby. Now, Derby is an amazing place. Depending on the moon, the time of the month, the tide change is between 8 and 12 metres. So if you imagine what's 12 metres, three-storey building, something like that, the tide comes in 12 metres in 6 hours, and then it goes out 12 metres in 6 hours. It's amazing. I'm the world's worst fisherman, but I said to Kathy, I want to catch a barramundi. So we paid a fishing guide to take us. There's St. Catherine, as I call her. So we go into this river, and the sandbars is just sand, and he would literally drive the boat up onto the sand, and then the tide would pick us up in a minute and move us forward. And then he'd do it again and again. The tide came in at walking pace. Top right is a crocodile slide. And there were crocodiles all around. Then the guy jumped out, caught these little mullet, etc. And sometime during the day, bang, a barramundi on Kathy's, you know, Kathy's line. She's pulling it in. Much screaming and excitement, squealing, etc. And there we are. Now, as that happened, the fishing guide was so excited. He was jumping up and down and yahoo! No, he wasn't. Bored out of his brain. It's kind of like looking at his watch. So you pull in that fish and he's looking at his... He said at the end of the day, time to go back now. And he took us back. And crocodiles, barramundi, and he's bored. Everything gets boring. You walk into a golf shop and I guarantee the guy or girl sitting behind the counter is bored. Why? They love golf, so they started a golf shop. Now what? They don't get to play golf anymore. Or I talk to men and women around the city who move billions of dollars around in funds. And I say, boy, that must be exciting. And they say, oh, yeah, I guess. But the law. Now, the law would never have a dull or wearisome moment, would it? Really, I know. You guys, I've watched Boston Legal and I hear about suits. It must be great, yeah? Oh, okay. Well, maybe even the law can get wearisome, man. All right, verse 8. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. By the way, I should declare an interest. I'm about to take long service leave in August and go on a trip to the USA and Canada and a cruise, okay? Good. So, travel. If you think the travel is the meaning of life and you've got the travel bug, the more you travel, the more you want to. The eye never has enough. Or television. Remember, I'm old enough to remember when our family got their first television, this kind of box arrived, and then you'd watch it for a while, and then a test pattern would come on. You young guys don't even know what a test pattern is, do you, right? Test pattern would come on, and go, and then that's it. There's nothing to watch. Thanks for coming. All right? Colour television when I was in high school, and then digital TV, 20 channels, and you'd sit down, flick through them, nothing to watch. Then Foxtel, 150 channels. I'd sit down, flick through them, nothing to watch. Now I've got Netflix, 1,569 television shows, 4,010 movies. I sit down, nothing to watch. The eye never has enough of seeing. Social media, is that enough? The Atlantic magazine, every 2 minutes, got this, every 2 minutes, humans take more photos than ever existed in total 150 years ago. Got that? 150 years ago, total number of photographs ever taken. We do that in 2 minutes now. 1.8 billion images uploaded every day. If you're on Snapchat, you're busy. 8,700 images a second. The eye just said, why? Because we're bored. We need more and more and more. Or the ear. Notice the ear never has a fill of hearing. Why do we need new songs? Seriously, why do we need... First of all, every decent song was written in the 80s. Or, well, maybe the beginning of the 90s. Yep, okay. Or possibly earlier, George. Yeah, possibly. I checked Spotify, just to show you that I'm with technology. Spotify, you can get whatever you want. 30 million songs. 30 million songs, and they upload 20,000 a day. Now, why can't we actually say, thanks, that's all we need? because the ear never has enough of hearing nor... Okay, verse 9, I've got to push on. What will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. Every 3 years, our political leaders come along and they promise us change and things will be different. And I know they mean well, and it's not a, this is not a partisan political statement, but will things really change? Or the United States, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. She's the, I think, the hope of the Democrats at the moment, young and withered and plans to make the USA a more fair place, and I hope she can. She can't run for president yet because she's only 29 years old. You have to be 35 to be able to run for president. Will she change things? Well, can you remember back to about 2006 when there was another young Democrat, the great hope of the Democratic Party, and he said he was going to change things and everything would be wonderful? And in fact, Barack Obama's speeches were put out, and the title of the book was We Are the Change We Seek. How much did things change? Well, I don't know. Can you remember 2014 when there was another man from a kind of different background turned up and said he was going to change things? Interesting. When that man got in, people wept as they thought about the changes he would bring. When this man got in, the same people wept when they thought about the changes he would bring. Not a political statement. My point is just how hard it is to actually bring real change or do something new. You might say, oh, well, no, wait a minute. What about technology? Technology's always changing. Well, yes, technology's got better and better, or if you like, more and more powerful over time, from the fishing net to the internet, or the clay tablet to the iPhone tablet or whatever, okay. But you know what? The human problem hasn't changed. It's easier to talk to someone on the other side of the world often than to talk to someone across the breakfast table. Or I can pick up my phone and with a touch of a finger I can talk to my dad and still not know what to say. And there may be people in your families who won't talk to each other because they can't forgive each other. Same world, same problem, messed up with greed and distrust and selfishness and violence. And you know what? It's actually easier. It's easier talking on this topic to people who are, you know, my age. I just hit the big 6-0, than it is to people who are kind of under 30. I'll tell you why. Because life hasn't bitten them yet. Kathy and I stopped at a roadhouse on the way back from Canberra a couple of weeks ago, and in the roadhouse are some of these game machines. And I couldn't wait to get a handful of $2 coins and rush over and drop them in and win some of these toys. No, I didn't. No one wins these things. Have you ever seen anybody win out of these? If you're listening on the recording, this is the one with the claw that comes down and picks up. And even if you did win, what do you get? Oh, I got this stuffed toy that looks like a smiley face, and then you take it home, you give it to your kids, and they throw it in the cupboard, and in 20 years, their mother throws it out. Like it, and you know what? Over time, more and more of life feels like that. Eat, sleep, work, repeat, and nothing really changes. Now, it's not that bad. It's worse, actually, because you look at verse 11. No one will remember you. See verse 11. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. No one will remember us. There's four names: John Watson, George Reed, Andrew Fisher, Joseph Cook. Don't say out loud, please. If you know who these four men are, would you just perhaps raise your hand? One, two. Ah, well done. There's about a third of the room. Normally, I've shown that list one person in 50. So well done. For those who didn't know, those four, Prime Ministers of Australia. Now, almost no one remembers them. And they were prime ministers. Do you think anyone will remember you? Or me, for that matter? You say, oh, no, my family will remember me. Really? How much do you know about your great-grandmother or great-grandfather? And they had great-grandchildren to be remembered. Eh? Anyway. All right, so under the sun. Aren't you glad you came for breakfast this morning? Under the sun, you'll go to work about 9,000 times. That's 18,000 commutes. You'll work your heart out. You'll be bored and frustrated. You won't be able to fix the problems that are there. The universe will roll on and nobody will remember you. You think, no, wait a minute. Settle down. That can't be right. There must be more to it than that. And my point of it, yes, there is more to it, but why do you think that? Why do you think that? Because when you look out under the sun, he's exactly right in his conclusions, isn't he? But here's the thing. That restlessness or that futility that we feel, that feeling of, no, there must be more than this, there's something wrong, is actually the kindness of God. And the New Testament says that God's put that feeling of frustration or futility, if you like, into our world. It's his kindness. So I'll show you, when the Apostle Paul wrote to the Christians in Rome, he says this, Romans chapter 8, verse 20. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. He's saying God's put this feeling of frustration or futility into our world, onto us. Now that word frustration there, interesting. Paul, the New Testament written in Greek, of course, but that word matiates, when the scholars came to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek for common usage around the world, that's the word they chose for hebel. That's the meaningless word. It's like saying this feeling of futility, meaninglessness, this what's wrong with our world, God's put it there. Why? To push us to look for hope. To push us to look, as he says there, for the freedom and glory of the children of God. There must be more than this. And so if you feel that restlessness, it's actually the kindness of God. Now let me wrap up. Where does Ecclesiastes go after this? I think what the writer says is this. The chill wind of reality and meaninglessness or purposelessness or that feeling that nothing lasts or whatever, it's very hard to live with that. And so we hide from it. And we hide from it in the pursuit of education or the busyness of work or more money or controlling our lives or whatever it is. And what he does, he goes on to show, these are houses of straw. See, verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Where are we? Here we go. Yeah, the quest for answers. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Look at verse 13. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. It's like the story, the rest of the book. It's only 10 pages in my Bible, so it's easy to read. It's like the story of the three little pigs and the wolf. And that is the first couple of pigs hide in a straw house, and the wolf comes along and blows it down. And so people hide from the chill wind of meaninglessness in work, in pleasure, etc., etc. And he goes along and says, it doesn't last. It doesn't last. It's empty in the end. Now, he doesn't say that these things are bad. He's not saying that money or work or food or wine or travel are bad. He's just saying they won't hold up if you make them the meaning of life. And here's what I think is a beautiful irony. When you realize that these things are not the meaning of life, career, success, money, travel, whatever, you can actually enjoy them more because you're not trying to make them perfect. You're not investing everything in them. They're just good things and you can enjoy them. And there's a much bigger answer to what gives life meaning and purpose. And that answer is, I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you why. He gets to the end in chapter 12, and if you haven't walked through the book, those 12 short chapters, the end, you don't realise the weight and significance of the end of the answer that he gives. So over the next 5 weeks, we'll work through. Next week, it's looking at wisdom and pleasure, or hedonism, as is it the answer. And we'll work our way through. You may like to actually read the book of Ecclesiastes yourself. If you'd like to read it with someone, let us know. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Verse Regarding the passage in front of you in verse 4, does the Bible as a whole teach that the earth remains forever? If not, what then does the teacher mean? That's true. So Ecclesiastes is working on the idea of, if you're just looking under the sun, how do you make sense of the world? And then other parts of the Bible will teach more information than that, of course. God has revealed himself. In fact, I think Ecclesiastes itself is part of the revelation from God. The Bible will teach that one day that the earth had a beginning, and I think science seems to point to that at the moment, and that one day God will, or Jesus will return, and there will be a new creation, a new heavens and a new earth. Verse 4 about the earth remains forever, I think it's rhetorical. He's just saying, look, you're here for 5 minutes, the world's always here. I think that's what he's saying. I'm not sure that he's making a geological or scientific statement. It's like when you say to someone, I've told you a million times, don't do that. Well, you know, it wasn't 999 whatever the time before. Should Christians be advertising their religion more on public transport? If someone has $1 million and they're thinking of that, come and see me. I think I've got other ideas. But, couldn't hurt, I guess. But it would only ever be background noise. And it's interesting that most people who become interested in the Christian faith become interested because they've met someone who lives out the Christian faith, and that gives their words credibility. But I guess some background noise wouldn't hurt. Do wealth and poverty affect the meaning of life? Yes. The Bible never says that wealth is a bad thing or poverty is a good thing. The issue with wealth, and we'll come to that in 2 weeks' time, the issue with wealth is, or Jesus teaches about that probably more than any other subject, that it's almost inevitable that our confidence, our self-worth and our security drifts into wealth if we feel wealthy. That money promises status and security and we start looking to that and it becomes our functional God. Poverty is never a good thing. In fact, Jesus says that his people should be generous to the poor and give to them. If money was a bad thing, Jesus wouldn't say give it to the poor. Okay, but poverty can push you to actually rely on or to be aware of your Creator and your need and humility. But the Bible does say a lot about caring for the poor, and Jesus was certainly in favour of that. Is work of some kind essential to make life meaningful? I think in the end, the way that we're wired up, the answer is yes. If the answer is of some kind, it doesn't have to be paid work, but I think we are wired up to be productive and to do things that are useful. Whether that be the unpaid work of caring for somebody or investing in some cause or turning up at work 9,000 times. You see, in the beginning, as God creates the man and the woman, puts them into the garden, he doesn't put them in there to be on holidays. He puts them in there to work the garden and to make it productive and to care for it, etc. So, yeah, I think that's right. You'd also need work that is appropriate to age and stage. So I guess I'd say rather than maybe paid work, to be doing something that feels productive. Is it sensible to follow Christ to avoid hopelessness, meaningless, whether or not you believe he physically rose from the dead? Interesting question. There are those theologians, I guess particularly in the 19th century, who in response to the Enlightenment and the teaching that, for example, miracles were no longer possible, they couldn't believe in the supernatural, they came up with a Christianity that didn't have the supernatural, didn't have the resurrection of Jesus, and you were operating on the basis of the Jesus of faith. And so whether he existed or not didn't matter. You operated on the Jesus of faith. That is very different to what the apostles in the New Testament see. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul says, if Christ isn't raised, we Christians are to be pitied more than all people because we believe things that are a lie. And so following Jesus in this life can actually be quite costly, And Paul's saying, if you're going to carry that cost, it's because of the promise of eternal life and Jesus' return. So I think if you to follow Christian morality, etc., without a belief in Jesus and the resurrection is to miss the whole point of Jesus' teaching. Second question, if you can avoid hopelessness by believing in something meaningful, does it really matter what or who that is? That's another good question. I think you can actually be quite happy following a number of different, quote, spiritual paths. It's what This Is Water, the American writer. He wrote that article. David Foster Wallace. If you haven't read the little article called This Is Water, it was a graduation speech that he gave where he said, you need to invest in something spiritual, because if you invest your life in money or power or something physical, in the end it'll let you down. Now, I think you'd be quite happy following different spiritual paths, if I could say, up to a point. Up to a point. Because Jesus says he is the only one that can give us forgiveness, and eternity is on the line there. And so ultimately, if you're not following Jesus, whatever else will let you down is what he taught. But I think in the short term, like the guy who jumped off the high building and halfway down said, so far so good, but you can be quite happy with other paths. So that's when you get down to not so much an opinion or et cetera. It comes down to objective truth and the objective truth claims of Christianity. We got time for one more, Josh? I've got three. People who don't believe in God People who don't believe in God don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. G.K. Chesterton. Take the new religion of climate change, which is nothing more than paganism dressed up. That's a statement. I think I'd just say it seems like climate change has, with some people, has approached more than just a worldview, has almost become a religion or a matter of faith, etc. I think that's probably true for some people. The meaninglessness of what... meaningless. What about Christian ministry? Is that meaningless? I'd have to say no, but sometimes it can feel like Groundhog Day. When you do feel meaningless, Havel... I can't get that... How do you deal with meaninglessness practically and spiritually? Okay, my point is this. The whole... I'm sorry if I haven't been clear. The whole book of Ecclesiastes, these 12 chapters, is an argument to push us out of living for stuff that ultimately won't last and won't hold the weight we put on it, and bring us to see something that really does have ultimate meaning, ultimate value, ultimate purpose. And he walks you through that. Now, along the way, he says these other things that we fill our lives with are good, G-O-O-D, just beware of crossing out an O and making it like a God thing, the centre of your life. So that's the point. In fact, once you get to the end and understand where he's pushing us to, I think you can enjoy all of these things along the way much more, because you're, how can I put it, they're in context and you're more relaxed about them. And I should stop now, George. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.